Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Hey, it's Latif from Radiolab. Our goal with each episode is to make you think, how did I live this long and not know that? Radiolab. Adventures on the edge of what we think we know. Listen wherever you get podcasts.
Today, we launched the latest installment of our book series called Full Bio. That's when we fully explore a deeply researched biography over the course of a week, day by day, so we can get into the details. Bob Spitz's new book, Led Zeppelin, The Biography, comes in at a whopping 688 pages. The band is one of the most successful in rock history, selling more than 300 million records. It all started with Jimmy Page, who was born in 1944 to working-class parents in a town southeast of London. As a young man, he hooked up with a teenager, a long-haired power singer named Robert Plant, who brought along his mate, a real drum basher called John Bonham. They rounded out the quartet with a fairly reserved chameleon-like bass player, John Paul Jones. Over the course of Led Zeppelin's 12-year existence as a quartet, its story involved musical genius, star power, tragedy, a lot of money, hubris, misogyny, and addiction. Author Bob Spitz has had a long career in the music industry behind the scenes and as a journalist. He worked on the road with Bruce Springsteen and Elton John, and he wrote a New York Times bestselling biography of the Beatles, as well as books about Ronald Reagan and Julia Child. I began the interview by asking him what he wanted to accomplish with this biography and how he went about it. Here's today's full bio conversation with Bob Spitz about Led Zeppelin, The Biography. So, Bob, one article I read suggested that there are more than 100 books about Led Zeppelin with varying degrees of success, both commercially as written works. What goal did you set out for yourself, and what gap did you hope this book would fill?
Well, I wanted to make it definitive. I mean, I really felt that this group, like so many rock bands, had been not well served by either their writers, hagiographers, fanboys, all the people who have done books on these bands before. And, you know, I did the same thing when I wrote about the Beatles. There had been maybe close to 400 books on the Beatles, and I had read all of them and decided that none of them served the purpose of telling this true story of a band. And so I go back to the very beginning. I always believe that you can't tell who a band is until you know where they come from. So I go to their hometown, I talk to their friends, I talk to their family, I get a sense of their cultural backgrounds of these bands, and try to give you a background on the music as well, where they develop their interest in songs. And the other thing that I always try to do, as opposed to all the other books that I've read about these bands, is that I want to let my reader know where the source notes are, who said what. In the Led Zeppelin book, I have 65 pages of source notes, so that when you page through, you'll say, Jimmy Page said that. I wonder where that came from. Mm-hmm. Well, I'll tell you where it came from, because I want you to know.
You know, obviously, surviving members of Led Zeppelin and their teams know you're writing this book or knew you were writing this book. Did any of them reach out to you as you were writing the story, either to say they didn't want to talk to you, or maybe I'll talk to you on background?
Mm-hmm. Actually, funnily enough, they were all set to talk to me, the surviving members. And as I began my research, Me Too hit. And as soon as Me Too hit, their lawyers told them they weren't talking to me, which I found very interesting. Luckily, I found about 70 to 120 hours of interviews that they had given, audio interviews that had never been either published or had been lost for the longest time. And I was able to use those and integrate them so that you feel like you hear the band members telling their own story throughout the book. Would I have loved to have had them as sources? Absolutely. Knowing that they were going to cooperate, I was very optimistic, but you know, I think the Me Too impact that it had on rock and roll was very valuable. And if it meant that these guys weren't going to talk to me, so be it.
And we'll discuss exactly why their lawyers would tell them to lawyer up. My guest is Bob Spitz. The name of the book is Led Zeppelin. So the first sentence of chapter one is interesting. In the beginning, there was the blues. Before jazz, before swing, and long before rock and roll, the blues gave voice to African-American life in a world of harsh reality. Why is that the first line in a book about four British lads who would play hard rock?
Because something very unusual happened post-World War II in the UK, and that is the kids who were, you know, the next generation of teenagers had a fascination with American blues. We missed it here in the States. It didn't happen. We had Elvis Presley and the kids went straight into doo-wop. But in the UK, all these young kids were listening to, you know, B.B. King and Willie Dixon and Little Walter and Jimmy Reed, especially. All the great R&B singers who gave influence to rock and roll. And so that we have all that early influence on Led Zeppelin and the Yardbirds that came from the blues, and especially the Rolling Stones and John Mayall and all those great British bands. Their education was couched in the blues. And I thought, before we get into Led Zeppelin, we better talk a little bit about where how the blues influences.
So if you're a British teenager at this time looking to hear the blues or to find the blues anywhere, where do you go?
You know, there was no internet. Mm-hmm. So they had records. It was the only way that they could get to that music. Fortunately, there were so many American servicemen who decided to stay and live in the UK after the war. In fact, Jimmy Page learned how to play baseball in school and not rugby or soccer because there were so many American kids in their class. They had records. They had blues records. And so they either got them from the American servicemen or they ordered them from the record companies. And it took them weeks and weeks to get those records shipped from the United States. They were not available in the UK. And these kids were intrepid. I mean, they got the blues bug. They wanted to find out more about it. And I know Robert Plant and Jimmy Page's neighbor, Dave Williams, who was a very valuable source of mine, spent all their disposable income, and there wasn't much of it, ordering blues albums from the States.
In the book, we learn early on that Jimmy Page was really into James Burton. We're going to play a little clip of him playing.
So hello, Mary Lou, goodbye, heart.
What was it about Burton that made a real imprint on him, and who else do you think was really important to Jimmy Page's foundational work as a musician?
Yeah, James Burton had the touch. He was just an amazing guitar player and played on so many different sessions in the United States, the same way Jimmy Page would go on to play for so many sessions in the UK. In fact, Jimmy Page really discovered James Burton on, of all things, Ricky Nelson records. And so Jimmy had an entire collection of Ricky Nelson records just so he could listen to James Burton over and over again to try to decipher what this guy was doing so that he could try to duplicate it at home. So we listened to that. He listened to Scotty Moore, of course, Elvis's background musician, and just had, you know, whatever he could get his hands on, he listened to.
How did Jimmy Page get his hands on a guitar?
There was a guitar in his parents' house when they moved in. It was some old ratty Spanish model. They thought it was just decorative, and it sat in the corner of his parlor, what they called their living rooms, for a long time, and nobody touched it. And so finally, Jimmy restrung the guitar and the action on it. In other words, the way that the strings sat on the fretboard on the neck was horrible. So he sanded that down. He made that guitar a little playable. And then he had a friend at school tune it for him so he could actually put it in tune and try to play music on it. And that really did it for him. That was the bug. He got into it, and then he talked his parents into buying him a better model.
It's so interesting that he, early on, clearly had enormous talent, so much so that he landed a job as a musician when he was about 15. What was the job, and why did his parents ultimately let him go?
The job was to play background music. Actually, no, I'm wrong. He played with a group called Reddy Lewis and the Red Caps, and they were basically a cover band. They played the hits of the day, and they toured the UK wherever they could get a gig. His parents let him go because the manager of the band, a guy named Chris Tidmarsh, who will come into our story later on, was kind of the Eddie Haskell character in that band. And he could talk Jimmy's parents into anything. Oh, Mr. and Mrs. Page, don't worry. We'll take good care of James. We'll get him home every night so he could go to school the next day. And of course, their gigs ended about 3 o'clock in the morning. Jimmy got up at 7:30 to go to school. And that went on for a couple years.
My guest is Bob Spitz. Today's full bio is all about Led Zeppelin. I did want to put a little asterisk here. You know, you write about a place called Epsom, like as in Epsom salts in the UK, and that Jimmy Page, Jeff Beck, Eric Clapton all came from around this area at one point in their lives. What was going on there?
Well, something was in the water for sure. I mean, these guys not just lived in the same town, they lived 5 minutes from each other. And not only Jeff Beck and Eric Clapton and Jimmy Page, but Glyn Johns, who went on to become one of the greatest producers of all time, and Ian Stewart, who was really the sixth man of the Rolling Stones, who played piano for them and was with them as long as he was alive. Everybody was in that town for some reason. But, you know, it's not so much that they lived in Epsom. There was another ferment of music going on at that point, and one in Epsom as well, and that was art colleges. And that's something I think we should talk about at some point, too.
That was my segue into art school.
There we go.
Yeah, it was just interesting that so many musicians met at art school. Why was that a place at this time? Why would they meet at art school, and how would it influence them?
Well, anybody who was artistic and wasn't headed to college, and that was basically anybody who was interested in rock and roll, were funneled into what they called art colleges, more or less a technical school. And they were all over the UK. I mean, there were many of them. And it was a wonderful thing because these guys didn't have to go to work at the age of 16 in some, you know, dead end job, and they could pursue their interests and really develop their creative interests. So you have guys like Keith Richards and Eric Clapton and Pete Townsend and Brian Ferry and all in art schools all over the UK, and every art school had a band. You know, there were artists in art school, of course. Jimmy purportedly went there to draw, but because they had bands, they got to know each other and play music and trade blues records and talk about the latest phenomenons. And so all of this wonderful art and rock and roll especially came out of these so-called technical schools that they called art colleges in the UK. I wish we had them here. I would have gone to one.
You write, quote, "Jimmy's mad passion became sound."
Oh yeah, Jimmy not only wanted to play the music, but it had to sound right. It had to have the right touch. And then once he developed the right touch, he was interested in the sounds guitars could make. I mean, Jimmy played one of the very first fuzz boxes. Fuzz boxes were those wonderful kind of reverb electronic instruments that could make the guitar sound like a buzzing bee. Before this, a few intrepid rock and rollers would slash their amplifiers to try to get that sound. But Jimmy had a friend who worked for the Admiralty, and he was developing sonar waves for submarines. So sound was his specialty. And Jimmy said to him, "Can we do something about developing sounds like that for guitar?" And so this guy, Roger Mayer, developed a fuzz box and went on to develop sounds for everybody, including Jimi Hendrix and Stevie Wonder. But it all started there in Jimmy's living room. In the early days, there would be Sunday afternoon get-togethers. And in that living room would be Jeff Beck and Eric Clapton, Roger Mayer with his fuzz box. You know, a couple of times Glyn Johns would walk through, and these boys would just sit there and dream and play music together.
You're listening to today's Full Bio conversation with Bob Spitz about Led Zeppelin, the biography. After the break, we'll hear how the four members of the band united for the first time. This is AOI. This is All of It on WNYC. I'm Allison Stewart. We continue today's Full Bio conversation about the new book, Led Zeppelin, The Biography by Bob Spitz. It didn't take Jimmy Page long to realize he wanted more from his music career than to play other people's songs, and that's where we pick up the story. Jimmy Page had a successful career as a session musician. Why did he embrace that?
Well, his friend Glyn Johns became a producer early on needed a guitar player. And at the time, the guitar players really came out of either the jazz background for session work, or they played with the London Philharmonic. And they had no feel for rock and roll. So that when Glyn had a session for a rock and roller, he thought, you know, I know this kid who lived near me in Epsom. I'm going to ask him if he wants to play a session play the guitar on a session. And Jimmy said he'd do it. And before he knew it, he was in such demand. He was doing three sessions a day, 6 days a week, out earning his father, out earning his mother and father combined, and really spinning through a revolving door with such a varied group of artists that he was backing, that he would back, say, one day, you know, The Who or Gene Vincent, the next day, Burt Bacharach, and Jimmy even played background on Shirley Bassey's Goldfinger. It was a great profession for him.
He was asked to join the Yardbirds and at first declined. Why?
Well, he declined because he knew that they were pushing Eric Clapton out of the Yardbirds. And Eric was his buddy, and he felt that Eric was getting a raw deal. Also, he was making so much more money as a session musician than playing with the Yardbirds. So that's why he declined.
Well, what made him accept the second time around when they came back and asked again?
Well, he actually, Jeff Beck took him to hear the Yardbirds. They were playing at Oxford at one of these hoity-toity balls. And the Yardbirds on stage that night were so drunk and so bad, just blowing raspberries into the mic and playing off key. Jimmy sat there and he thought, this is one of the greatest things I've ever seen. I want to be part of it. Also, on stage that night, the band was breaking up. This was going to be it. And so Jeff Beck, who had just joined the Yardbirds, said, hey, come on, let's do it. You and I will be a tandem guitar. You can play bass first. I'll play guitar. And Jimmy just, you know, he had been in the studio as a session player for so long and was burning out. He thought to himself, yeah, I'd love to play with a band again. And this was his opportunity.
So Jimmy Page, he joins the Yardbirds. And at one point, he thinks Robert Plant would be a great addition to the Yardbirds. Jeff Beck exits. Plant was already in a band called Band of Joy. What was the word in the street about this kid, Robert Plant?
Well, actually, there was no word on the street about Robert Plant. Jimmy wanted to form a new band out of the Detroitists of the Yardbirds. He was calling it the New Yardbirds. And nobody would be in it but Jimmy Page at the beginning. And then his buddy John Paul Jones, who also was a session player. But he needed that vocalist. And his dream for a vocalist was really a guy named Terry Reid, who was just emerging as a British white R&B singer. But Terry had a recording contract with Epic Records at the time and decided that he was going to just stay as a soloist. So he recommended Robert Plant. And Jimmy went to hear him and at a teacher's college in, I believe it was in the Midlands someplace. And there were only about 15 people in the audience. And Jimmy was blown out of his chair. He heard this guy's voice. Robert was 19 at the time and thought, there's got to be something wrong with this guy. He has an incredible voice, an amazing stage presence. He doesn't have a band. I mean, he was playing with a bunch of amateurs. Jimmy just assumed he was a head case and nobody would touch him. But Robert, you know, Robert was just kicking around at the time. And Jimmy decided he was going to give him a try. And they got together at Jimmy's boathouse, where he was living at the time. And that was the beginning right there of what became Led Zeppelin.
And Robert Plant, I won't say he brought along John Bonham but they were in the band together. They were in Band of Joy together, right?
They were. They had lost touch, intermittently. They went out with different bands and every once in a while they would meet up and reform the Band of Joy. John at the time was playing with behind an artist named Tim Rose, an American who was working in the UK, and was set to go on tour with him. And Robert talked him into at least listening to Jimmy Page's pitch, and they made him a good offer. And yes, I guess you could say that Robert brought his mate into the band.
You write about John Bonham. He is quoted as saying, I never had any drum lessons. I just played the way I wanted. What was unique about him?
Well, not only did John play the way he wanted, he lived the way he wanted as well. And we'll get into that a little later. But he, he was what they called a basher. He played with his muscles. And that was problematic with a lot of the bands in the Midlands where he was paying his amateur dues because he was just too damn loud. And they would, whatever band he played with, would not be around for another date at that particular club because They always said, not with that drummer. He's just too loud. John didn't care. As you said, Allison, he played the way he wanted, and that was loud and forcefully.
My guest is Bob Spitz. He's the author of Led Zeppelin. It's our choice for full bio. And let's finish out today talking about John Paul Jones. You write about him, the guy was a chameleon. What does that mean?
Well, just basically, nobody ever recognized John Paul Jones. He had a really vanilla frosting face. And so at the height of Led Zeppelin's career, when they couldn't walk on the street or go anywhere without being mobbed, John Paul Jones would very often walk in with all the fans to the gig. They had no idea who he was. He just blended into the woodwork. But he was also a chameleon as a musician. He could play anything. And in fact, Glyn Johns, the producer, told me when he heard that John Paul was going to be in the band with Jimmy, he knew they'd be successful because he felt John Paul Jones was, in his words, a genius. And he was brilliant. He could play anything.
That was my conversation with Bob Spitz, author of the new book, Led Zeppelin, The Biography, our choice for full bio this week. Next time, we'll hear about how Led Zeppelin got a record deal and why they were embraced by fans here in the States, but not so much at home in the UK, and why.